Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhaus. This week, Rachel Swarns traces the roots and branches of the First Lady's family tree.
Even Mrs. Obama grew up not knowing very much about her own history, like so many people.
Julie Bosman has notes from the field. Dexter Filkins explains the brutal logic of Syria.
This is the really chilling part. What can they do except fight it out to the end? And I think we're seeing that now.
And Greg Coles has bestseller news. More than 3 years after Barack Obama took office and his wife, Michelle, became the First Lady, America still is sifting through the complexity and surprises of having an African-American first family. There's an important new book. It's called American Tapestry, the story of the Black, White, and multiracial ancestors of Michelle Obama. It's by one of the Times' great reporters, Rachel Swarns, and it's reviewed for us on our cover by Edward Ball, who says American Tapestry is a fascinating account of the First Lady's family that reads at times like a saga or miniseries. I'm delighted that Rachel is joining us to talk about her book. Welcome.
Thank you.
All right, so we have this very complicated story to tell. Let me just ask you about one person, and then we'll get going. Tell us about Melvinia, Mrs. Obama's great-great-grandmother.
Three greats. Melvinia was her great-great-great-grandmother. And she was a slave girl who was valued about $475 in the 1850s. And she is the one in Mrs. Obama's family tree who had a biracial son. And the story of who the father was and this child and where he went and where his descendants went is really the underpinning of this book.
And how do you, as a reporter, learn about her? How did you track this story, investigate it, and then report it?
What happened was I was covering Mrs. Obama for the Times, and sometime in that first year, it was around September, the first year that they were in the White House, we got a call from a genealogist who had done some research into Mrs. Obama's family. And she had discovered Melvinia back in the 1850s, and this biracial son. And she said, listen, I think we've got something amazing here. And I got on a plane to Birmingham and started digging into the family. And it became a front page story that ran in October of that year. And that was the genesis of this book.
Rachel, our reviewer, Edward Ball, who's a distinguished historian, mentioned some of the topics and themes in your book. I'm going to read some of it to you and then ask you to fill it in a little bit. He says that this is a story. One reason the story is so important is because it's almost a microcosm of the experiences that some 40 million Americans, African Americans, will have in their pasts. Here's what he says. Generations of forced work on Southern farms, sexual exploitation, children born half-white, attempts to free slavery, emancipation at the end of a rifle barrel, terrorization by the Klan during Reconstruction, futility stirred in with pleasure and church in the 1900s, a stepladder into the working class. How do you unpack all those different pieces of the story?
You know, I told the story through members of her family and through the lives of the people who I discovered over time. And, you know, it is hard history. These are hard stories talking about slavery, about the questions of whether you have a situation where a young slave girl is raped or whether there is a situation where there is something more there, relationships perhaps. These are not easy things. But it really is our history, American history. It is our story, both the story of many African-American families, but also the story of many white families, too, whose lines emerge from that period of time.
Rachel, one of the questions that came up during the election in 2008 is questions about the president, Barack Obama, identifying himself as African-American. I remember we would get letters here at the Book Review when we published reviews of books about him or by him. And they would say, well, no, he's not entirely African-American. He's half African American. And your story makes us see that in some sense, that's almost an irrelevant question because of the great quantity of intermixing of the races that goes back so far.
Yeah, that's right. I think, you know, we often think about our current time as this time of, you know, unprecedented rates of interracial marriage and immigration. And certainly President Obama's family story, he's the son of a white woman from Kansas and a black man from Kenya, has attracted a lot of attention. But really, Michelle Obama's family story is probably much more representative. And back in the 1800s, late 1890s, there was so much mixing going on. And, you know, this story focuses in a lot of ways on Melvinia, who is her great-great-great-grandmother on her mother's side. But I found that all four of Mrs. Obama's grandparents had multiracial roots. You know, there were Irish Americans who were nurturing their dreams in this new land. There were slaves who worked on vast plantations, rice plantations, and those who worked on small farms. There were mixed race people who lived free, you know, during the time of slavery. And some of those people claimed Native American ancestry. So, you know, really contemporary America emerged from this kind of, you know, melange of people.
Rachel, a point that you make in your book and our reviewer highlights as well is that while this history seems extraordinarily rich to us, the history of slavery and its aftermath, it doesn't necessarily feel so rich to many of those who come into the legacy. For instance, you say that there's an almost willful collective forgetting and intentional loss of memory within the African American community, kind of like, you know, in the way that Jews don't often want to talk about the Holocaust. Where do the Obamas, and Michelle in particular, stand in relationship to this history, say as far as their own children go?
You know, I found this kind of silence repeatedly in so many branches of her family tree, and not only among the African Americans, among the white ancestors too. These stories are hard stories, and I think among her African American ancestors, even close relatives, aunts and uncles, said, you know, we try to talk to our grandparents and great-grandparents and to ask them about slavery and to ask them what they knew about this history of white ancestry, and people didn't want to talk about it. Even Mrs. Obama grew up not knowing very much about her own history, like so many people. She vacationed, spent summers with relatives in South Carolina, not far from the rice plantations where her ancestors lived, but they never talked about that. And she, in previous interviews, has marveled, you know, we talked about a lot of things, but we didn't talk about that. She herself, though, has taken up slavery a bit in terms of giving it a little more attention since she's been in the White House. She's talked to children visiting the White House about how the White House itself was built with slave labor. She and the president went to Ghana and to Cape Coast, where slaves were sent off. And she's visited Monticello with her children. So I think she has an interest in this history. But unpacking it and really digging back was not easy.
Thanks so much, Rachel.
Thank you.
That's Rachel Swarns, whose book, American Tapestry, the story of the black, white, and multiracial ancestors of Michelle Obama, is reviewed on the cover of this week's book review. Julie Bosman's here with Notes from the Field. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Sam.
So the enigmatic Thomas Pynchon is heard from?
Sort of. We got news this week that he has agreed to make all of his backlist, his 8 books available in ebook format for the first time. Now, he was one of the last great holdouts, one of the authors who had stubbornly stuck to print all these years, even as ebook sales, especially in fiction, have gone up and up and up.
Who's his publisher these days?
His publisher of his most 2 recent books is the Penguin Press, the imprint at Penguin run by Anne Godoff. And Penguin has now gone back and purchased all the digital rights to his previous books as well, even the ones that they did not publish.
So going all the way back to V, and so there'll be the short story collection and everything else. You know, what's interesting about Pynchon, now he is in some ways the godfather of very technologically sophisticated fiction, but he's really kind of a Luddite, isn't he?
In a way, yes. And it took a really long time for him to be convinced to make these books available. Now, one interesting thing that came out of my reporting on this story is that it was incredibly complicated to convert his books into ebooks because they are so long, so detailed. The page layouts are complicated. So on the technical side, it was very difficult for Penguin to format his books and make them look the way that they do in print in ebook format.
So they're duplicating them as ebooks. Right, he has drawings and diagrams and complicated things. Now, who persuaded him? Do we know who changed Thomas Pynchon's mind?
We don't know exactly, but Anne Godoff told me that she talked with him personally. She, of course, spoke with Melanie Jackson, his wife and agent, who surely played a role in this. But as Anne described it to me, he finally said, you know, he wanted to get on board. He felt that the time was right to make all of his books available. And she said, like any writer, he wants to have as many readers as he can possibly get. Now, this isn't going to change his public profile.
That doesn't mean he wants to meet them all.
No, he doesn't really want to contact them at all. But he does want people who read only ebooks rather than print books to have access to his work. And, you know, what we've seen in the last 6 months to a year when it comes to fiction and ebooks is really incredible. It is very common for a new novel to sell more copies in ebook than in print. And if you're a writer who wants your work to be read, then you're really missing out on a huge chunk of readers if you're only available in print.
Julie, do we know or can we approximate roughly how many of these, let's call them dedicated ebook readers, are younger? Are they older? Are they really a different group, or are they the same readers just switching over to this other format?
Well, when ebooks and e-readers really became popular, it was an older audience. It's still primarily women, but the first people to read, on Kindles and Nooks were really women in their 50s and 60s, you know, people who read a lot of books, who could justify the, you know, $350 price for the original Kindles. Now it's really, you know, spreading younger and younger and more male. It's still primarily female from what we can tell, but it really does go across the board. I mean, informally and completely unscientifically, I can say that, you know, riding the subway in the morning, I always see younger people, you know, people in their 20s, 30s, 40s, reading on dedicated e-reader devices and also, of course, on, you know, their iPhones and various smartphones where you can read from a Nook app or a Kindle app. So I think that publishers are really responding to the fact that ebooks are being read by so many more people now, and they're trying to dig into their backlists, digitize them, and make those works available.
See, I can imagine where if you're Thomas Pynchon, you're in your mid-70s, been a major literary figure for half a century, you're growing increasingly aware of this phenomenon of people are reading on devices and all the rest, and your publisher and agent and other people tell you there actually is a visible universe of readers out there. You can see them all over the place, but they're reading in this other way. And if you want them to read your stuff, this is what you might do. And it's the reason I ask is because that makes sense, but it also makes sense, as you say, that a lot of the readers who are turning now to devices are people who might have read Thomas Pynchon in paperback, say, 20 or 30 years ago. So it's not as if it's an entirely new generation of readers. Is that right?
That's right. I mean, you do have people now who are digital natives who really don't buy print books at all. And when you think about his readers, you know, he would not want to miss out on all of those people who are reading only digitally. Now, he joins a group of very prominent authors just in the last few months who have made a similar decision. Ray Bradbury, who, of course, died just last week, said last fall that he would allow Fahrenheit 451 to be sold as an ebook, despite previously saying that ebooks, quote, smell like burned fuel. Judy Blume made her backlist, I think 13 books available recently. J.K. Rowling made the Harry Potter series available in ebook for the first time just a couple of months ago. So I think that there is this group of authors who, you know, very slowly and a little bit late, but are finally changing their mind on this. And it's really kind of the another step toward the ubiquity of the ebook.
Thanks so much, Julie.
Thanks, Sam.
Well, the story of Syria is with us still. There's an important new book. It's called The Syrian Rebellion. It's by Fuad Ajami. It's reviewed for us by the legendary Dexter Filkins, staff writer at The New Yorker and the author of The Forever War. And I'm delighted that Dexter's here to talk about it. Welcome, Dexter.
Thanks.
All right, The Syrian Rebellion. Ajami, he's a consequential guy. Where do we stand now? What's his argument in this book?
This is a really good book. I mean, when you think of how fast events are moving in Syria, that he could stop and essentially write to give you both a snapshot of the uprising and at the same time a historical context and for why and how it's happening. Really remarkable that he could basically write this book on deadline like that. I think the central argument of this book, and I think why it's so useful, why I found it so useful, is that Ajami argues pretty persuasively that the Assad family project in Syria, which has been going on now for 40 years, was essentially sectarian. And this is the Alawites, it's 10% of the population or less, run and control the country. And what that means, and I think this is why, this is the really chilling part, what can they do except fight it out to the end? And I think we're seeing that now.
What's the snapshot he gives us of this moment? Now, have you been there? Have you reported from Syria?
Yeah, absolutely.
And tell us what's it like and what aspects of it Ajami has captured well.
I don't think he goes into the country physically to report this book. But what he does so well in this book is sort of weave the current events with the historical context. So what you have, of course, with Syria, I mean, all you have to do is look at Syria, the long straight lines of its borders. They look like they were drawn with a ruler. And, of course, they were. You know, Syria was essentially a conjured up out of the desert by, you know, Gertrude Bell and Winston Churchill in Cairo and other places. But it was
– And when was this?
The collapse of the Ottoman Empire following World War I. The modern Middle East was created. The map makers got out their pens and they drew all these countries, Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, and without much regard for tribal lines, without much regard for the way that these countries, the way that the region actually lives and functions. And so, you know, these lines that they drew in the sand are still with us today. And Ajami shows that so well because, you have Syria. It's a country that is 80% Sunni Muslim, and they're not in power. And where else have we seen that in the Middle East? We saw it in Iraq, where Iraq was governed by a minority of Sunni Arabs, maybe 15% of the population. We saw it in Lebanon, and where it was governed by a Christian minority. Both those countries, as we know, went through terrible sectarian bloodbaths. And I think the big question, the one that this book raises so well, is whether this is going to become a great sectarian bloodbath in Syria as well.
So you mentioned in your essay, Dexter, there's a kind of brutal logic that gets played out. Is that what we're seeing now? There's just an end game we have to follow. There's no great intervention. There's no sudden solution. It's just a fight to the death.
That's certainly what it looks like. That is pretty clearly what Ajami argues in his book. And it's also, you know, just pick up the newspaper, that appears to be what's happening. And the brutal logic is this, right? It's the Alawites. They are a minority sect of Shia Islam, and they're, you know, 10% or so of the population in Syria. And they run everything. They own most of everything. What conceivable incentive do they have to compromise? They know they're doomed. If they surrender, they are doomed. And they know that.
And when you say doomed, you mean it in the most literal way?
Well, imagine. What could they – how could they possibly come out of this well? It's hard to imagine. I mean, what would a deal look like where okay, you step down and then and all is forgotten? A minority that size, it's not going to happen. And I think Ajami shows that really well. You know, not in the Middle East. They're going to fight it out. This is going to get worse.
And for how long? Do we have any idea how long this will go
well,
on?
Well, I think Ajami says, and I think, again, just pick up the paper and you get a feel, how long can Assad hang on? I think that's going to depend as much. He has demonstrated his willingness to kill thousands and thousands of his countrymen. And as long as he has the support of, you know, Russia, China, and Iran, he can probably keep doing it for a while.
Thanks a lot, Dexter.
Thank you.
That's Dexter Filkins, who reviews The Syrian Rebellion by Fuad Ajami in this week's book review. Greg Coles is here with Bestseller News. Hey, Greg.
Hi, Sam.
All right. Now, I know you were not able to write this week's column, but also you're a maestro of the list. So tell us what's new on the list this week.
Well, on the fiction side of things, there's a new book at number one. It's Laurel K. Hamilton's Kiss the Dead. It's a vampire book, part of a series that she writes of vampire mystery romances.
Okay, stop right there. You're telling me somebody's written a novel that has vampires in it?
It's
people
strange,
are actually buying
right?
it?
At number two, not a vampire book, but another mystery, Gillian Flynn's third book, Gone Girl, is getting great reviews. It's about a wife who disappears on the eve of her fifth wedding anniversary, and her husband comes under suspicion for possible murder, and it really becomes a story of their marriage. In some ways, it shares a storyline with, like, Tim O'Brien's In the Lake of the Woods, where a wife disappears and the husband's not sure if he killed her or not. In this one, you hear from the husband and you hear from the wife, and they're both big liars, liars to each other, liars to the reader, and you need to keep reading on to find out, did he kill her? Is she even dead?
That is about the most enticing description of a novel I've heard in years. You make this thing sound fantastic. Have you read it?
I'm just that good. No, I haven't.
What about anything else? Anything?
At number five, there's a book called Spring Fever by Mary Kay Andrews. Down at number 12, new on the list, is a new Bourne book, the Robert Ludlum character, Jason Bourne. This guy, Eric Van Lustbader, has continued the Bourne series since Ludlum's death. And the new book in that series is called The Bourne Imperative. And then at number 15, there's a new book on the list called Red Shirts by a guy named John Scalzi. He's a science fiction writer. He's done some satires, and this one is a satire of the Star Trek series. Red Shirts, I don't know if you'll remember from the Star Trek series or not. Every time that the original Star Trek crew would go on an away mission somewhere to another planet, one of the low-ranking crew members, the people who would wear a red shirt, would always die on those missions. So it became kind of a running joke which red shirt is going to die now on the series. And so this novel is told from the perspective of a low-ranking crew member who finds out that this is what always happens, and he's trying to avoid the mission. It's filled with pop culture references to the original show, and it stands alone as a novel in its own right, too.
And how about nonfiction?
At number 13, there's a book called Winner Take All by a woman named Dambisa Moyo. She's an economist looking at China. At number 10, Joan Rivers is on the list with a book called I Hate Everyone, Starting With Me.
I must say, I saw the documentary about Joan Rivers. Have you seen this?
It came out a couple of years ago.
It is really quite extraordinary. She's just as hardworking as she claims, and there's a really kind of subversive, biting wit in what she does. She's an extraordinary figure.
Yeah, I mean, she was a real trailblazer, too. She's been doing this for a long time. She's sort of a proto-feminist as a comedian. She was one of the early comedians to really talk about women's issues, to talk about what it was like being a housewife and being just a wife in general.
And about sex in very direct ways.
Absolutely. I mean, there's something of the real kind of vaudeville shtick to what she does, that she's a real old style comedian, that it's easy to miss the subversiveness, but it's there.
Well, and some of our listeners will remember when she had this enormous public brawl with Johnny Carson, when he had been her great mentor. And I believe she became his favorite guest host because he would be away for 6 weeks. You know, reaping zillions in Las Vegas. And Joan was always there instead. And then she dared to sign a contract with another network and start her own. Not only that, he essentially tried to destroy her and came pretty close.
Wow.
Yeah, it was really quite a story back in the day. But you're too young and fresh to know about that.
And then two other new books on the nonfiction list this week. At number seven, a book called Eat and Run by the ultramarathoner Scott Jurek, co-written with Steve Friedman.
Is this the guy who's run, like, the longest?
Yeah, he holds the record for running the longest distance in a 24-hour period. It was something like 165 miles. Ultramarathons are just anything longer than a marathon. So you're talking real long-distance runners. And this guy has won the World Ultra Marathon Championships something like 7 years in a row. He's a vegan, and this book is partly about his vegan lifestyle, and he credits his diet with helping him be really an excellent runner. I mean, it's partly about his life as a runner. And then at number two, still nobody's been able to dislodge Ed Klein out of the number one spot on the nonfiction list since he debuted there at number one a month ago with his anti-Obama book, The Amateur. But if anyone's going to, David Limbaugh, Rush's brother, is trying. He makes his debut on the list at number two, his anti-Obama book, The Great Destroyer.
Do you know what the difference is between David Limbaugh's book on Obama and Ed Klein's? Is David Limbaugh sent me an autographed copy of his. Thanks a lot, Greg.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks for listening. And remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. You can tell us what you think of this show or any New York Times podcast by emailing podcasts@nytimes.com. I'm Sam Tannenhaus.